Welcome to the C.S. Lewis Festival Scholar Series. I'm your host, David Krause. The C.S. Lewis Festival, which I am co-founder, is held each September along the shores of Lake Michigan in beautiful Petoskey, Michigan. Over 22,000 people have attended a variety of cultural, educational, and religious events, most free and all are open to the public. The 2022 C.S. Lewis Festival, our 20th season, kicks off Friday, September 16th at the Great Lakes Center for the Arts in Petoskey and Bay Harbor, Michigan, with best-selling author, blogger, and memoirist Anne Voskamp. Anne is the author of multiple books, including the New York Times bestseller, 1,000 Gifts, A Dare to Live Fully Right Where You Are. To learn more, please go to the Lewis website at cslewisfestival.org. The second talk in this series, Lewis and War, is a marvelous presentation by Dr. David Downing, co-director of the Marion E. Wade Center at Wheaton College and co-holder of the Marion E. Wade Chair in Christian Thought at Wheaton, a position he holds with his wife, Crystal Downing. The title of David's talk is C.S. Lewis, Neither Patriot Nor Pacifist, But Patient. Be sure to stick around after the lecture to hear how you can keep the C.S. Lewis Festival lamp lit and keep this series coming. Now, enjoy Dr. David Downing.
Thank you for that introduction. This conversation you're having in the last hour definitely gave me a sense of deja vu at Elizabethtown. It's an Anabaptist college with a peace tradition, and we just had a forum on what to do in the Middle East. And on the table of four, on one side, we had some from the war college, the Army War College, who said we need to send in 100,000 troops. And on the other end of the table, the young woman was saying we need to reinvent the Peace Corps and send in teachers and doctors and nurses. And they couldn't have been further apart. Interestingly, they both quoted C.S. Lewis. Lewis said in a letter, if war is ever lawful, then peace may be sinful, which is, comes from one of his letters. And but on the other side, they were talking about, well, how many imps are there out there that are really seeking something different than the jihadist? And are we going to go in and have a lot of collateral damage once again, all the secondary effects of war that are so devastating? So it was interesting to hear some of that discussion from this group. I feel like Joe sort of awakened all the lions in the lion's den and said, it's your turn, David. And then he left, I noticed. So, because this is my topic, neither patriot nor pacifist, but patient. Actually, I think I have a little bit different take on the topic than what we've been saying so far. And also, I like the fact, I've heard that good talks have three points which alliterate, so I feel like I'm off to a good start just on the title page here. So, Lewis, I wouldn't say he was a patriot. If you read, he wasn't unpatriotic, but he was not, if you read Chesterton or Kipling or some of those folks, they really fit into the section in Joe's book about exceptionalism. The British and the Americans and the Germans and the French, they were all quite sure that they were God's chosen people. And Lewis and Tolkien, neither one give you good examples of that kind of attitude, that England is somehow especially chosen by God to fulfill his will in world history. And part of that is because he was, as you most of you know Lewis's life, he was born in Northern Ireland. And so he was always a bit of an outsider. Also, so was Tolkien. He came from South Africa to England. But as a Protestant from the north of Ireland, the young Lewis felt aligned with English interest, but not an Englishman. And I thought it was interesting to go back and, as I was looking at his letters, a certain amount of distancing between himself and his English surroundings. And so I think he never had that kind of reflexive patriotic zeal that you see in other writers of his generation. When they first had the call to war in 1914, they called for 100,000 to come forward for the British Expeditionary Force, and 750,000 volunteered right away. Everyone was very excited. Same thing happened in Germany. Everyone, for some reason, celebrates the beginning of a war. Tolkien and Lewis were not in that line of 750,000. Neither of them were eager to get involved in the war. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about him being something of an outsider who became the ultimate insider. Writing in 1954, now this is several decades after his coming to England as a boy, he's still remembering his sense of alienation or estrangement coming from Northern Ireland, the north of Ireland, to England. The flats of Lancashire, a dismal sight like the banks of the Styx. That's not the best first impression of England. The strange English accents which I was surrounded sounded like the voices of demons. To a child who had always lived near the sea and in sight of high ridges, it, the English landscape from Fleetwood to Euston, appeared as I suppose Russia might appear to an English boy, the flatness, the interminableness. On his destination, green Hertfordshire, Lamb calls it, but to a boy bred in County Down, it was flat Hertfordshire, flinty Hertfordshire, Hertfordshire of the yellow soil. So he really remembered what it was like as a young Irish lad coming to England, and I think he always had not quite the same reflexive response. Even in his letters, he says he loved Oxford and he loved the countryside. He wished he could move Oxford to the north of Ireland. But I would say he didn't love England as a country, but he loved the English countryside, which is something different. Joe, in his book, mentioned the Zeppelin bombing of Waterloo Station. It was very traumatic. This is the first terror bombing in World War I. We associate this with the Blitz of World War II. But this started in World War I. But notice Lewis's curious comment writing to his father about the Zeppelin bombing of Waterloo Bridge. The chief amusement here is the Zeppelins. We saw the bombardment of Waterloo Station last time they were here. At least that is what we were told it was. All you could see were some electrical flashes in the sky caused by the bombs. But somehow the chief amusement here is the Zeppelins. That's kind of an oddly detached attitude. His father wrote and said, things are getting dangerous in England. He was in Great Bookham, which is near London, and said, I wonder if you should come back home to Ireland. And Lewis is 15 years old, and he says, dear father, as far as I know, the siege of Great Bookham has not begun yet. And he says, I wish you would consider the lilies of the field. This is the young, unchristian Lewis, but very well-read Lewis. He's trying to tell his father to be less anxious. And he finally says, I think the best service we can do is just to continue with our studies and not panic. This is 15-year-old writing to his father. Interestingly, if you go back to learning in wartime, he makes many of the same points coming from a Christian point of view. But temperamentally, his sense was, we don't panic, just do the best work you can do in the position you're in. Interested to read Joe's book and then go back and remember Lewis's comment on actually being able to see the Zeppelins dropping bombs from a Great Bookham. So from spectator to frontline officer, much of this Joe covers in his book. This is in January 1917 when his older brother Warren is just been promoted to Lieutenant Congers, is slang for congratulations. Congers on being made real lieutenant. Is there any chance of your being made a real captain when this war is over? Which I hope to God will be before my valuable person gets anywhere near it. So that's what he's thinking in January 1917. He doesn't know that before the year is out, he will be on the frontline trenches in northern France. So 2nd Lieutenant C.S. Lewis, Somerset Light Infantry, arrives at the front on his 19th birthday. They had an interesting system. It's different than the U.S. Army in that if you go to Oxford or Cambridge University educated, you're automatically an officer, regardless of how much you know about the military. I'm sure most of you have read Surprised by Joy. When he got to the front lines, he had his sergeant, who was older and much more experienced, and he said, well, the Germans are right there across the field. Shouldn't we be lobbing a few shells in their direction? And the sergeant said, well, if we do that, they're liable to lob a few shells back in our direction. And he said, oh, that's good. That's a good thought. You know, and he said, they had an interesting sort of father-son relationship, he says. So but as Joe documents, he also received battlefront experience and battlefront injuries. This is the kind of thing they're looking at. He says, you couldn't even see a blade of grass. Memories of the last war haunted my dreams for years, he says. The war, the frights, the cold, the smell of HE high explosives, the horribly smashed men still moving like half-crushed beetles, the sitting or standing corpses, the landscape of sheer earth without a blade of grass. So this is him remembering in 1954 what had happened. He was only on the front for a matter of months, but these are the kind of memories that did not easily disappear from your imagination. A lot of Joe's emphasis is that so much anti-war novels, so much anti-war poetry. You think of Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon. Actually, his first book of poetry was called Spirits in Bondage, And there are some anti-war poems from the point of view of a soldier. This is one of them called French Nocturne. And he starts out by describing the jaws of a sacked village that have been swallowed up, that have swallowed up the sun, giving way to a pale green moon. And then he says, there comes a buzzing plane, and now it seems flies straight into the moon. Lo, where he steers across the pallid globe, and surely nears in that white land some harbor of dear dreams. False mocking fancy, once I too could dream. Now who can only see with vulgar eye that he's no nearer the moon than I, and she's a stone that catches the sun's beam. What call have I to dream of anything? I am a wolf, back to the world again, and speak of fellow brutes that once were men. Our throats can bark for slaughter, cannot sing. That sounds very much like Wilfred Owen or other anti-war poets. So he did have a period where he really recognized the horrors of being on the front line and wanted to write about it in his poetry. The imagery is interesting here. The whole idea of the wolf swallowing the sun is the Norse myth of Fenris, and that's the beginning of the end, the twilight of the gods when the wolf swallows the sun. He has several poems in which he mentions Fenris in his war poetry. But later on in Narnia Chronicles, Fenris shows up as the chief detective for the White Witch, and he's ultimately defeated. And even in that image, you can see a difference in attitude from his pre-Christian days when he assumed that chaos would eventually triumph to his Christian days when he assumed that obviously a Christian God would be able to overcome the forces of chaos. But this poem, I think it's good poetry in and of itself, but I also think it's unusual for Lewis in that he did have a strong anti, at least what it felt like to be on the front lines. He wrote about it very vividly. Lewis on the miseries of soldiery. For let us make no mistake, all that we fear from all kinds of adversity, severally, is collected together in the life of a soldier in active service. Like sickness, it threatens pain and death. Like poverty, it threatens ill lodging, cold, heat, thirst, and hunger. Like slavery, it threatens toil, humiliation, injustice, and arbitrary rule. Like exile, it separates you from all you love. It threatens every temporal evil, every evil except dishonor and final perdition to those who bear it like it no better than you would like it. So once again, very dramatically bringing together the life of a soldier. The last few sentences are interesting, though. It threatens every temporal evil. Well, there must be some other kind of evil that he wants to talk about that is not a part of a soldier's life. Every evil except dishonor and final perdition, and those who bear it like it no better than you would like it. And when you read that, you say, well, maybe he was something of a pacifist. Maybe he really is seeing the suffering soldiers on the front lines. But these words come from an essay that he wrote called Why I'm Not a Pacifist. So he was recognizing, and he's actually speaking to the pacifist society in Oxford. This is what I love about Lewis. He could just go into a group called the Pacifist Society and spend an hour talking about why he was not a pacifist. And so those words I just quoted came from a lecture he gave on why I'm not a pacifist. And that he's going to move on and talk more about why he's not a pacifist. That's why I want to get into the word patient. We were just talking about the just war, and he did say if war is ever lawful, the peace may sometimes be sinful. That actually comes from a letter in which he's critiquing the just war theory. If you want to see Lewis's own thoughts, that comes from volume 2, page 233. He talks about two of the provisions of a just war. One is there will be less violence through war than there would be through allowing tyranny. And another is that the war will leave the world in a better situation than before the war. And he says in this letter, well, those are imponderables. We can't know either one of those things. So he doesn't want to try to fight a just war based upon criteria which are impossible to prove beforehand. You would have to fight the war to find out whether or not that was possible. So just to summarize this essay, he says war is a great evil, but there may be greater evils. These are some of the things that Joe was just talking about. He was an admirer of Churchill, who said, nothing is worse than war. Tyranny is worse than war. Slavery is worse than war. Genocide is worse than war. So I think he would tend to resonate with Churchill and with some of the things that Joe was saying. He said that in this speech, only liberal societies can tolerate pacifism as an option. The very fact in the middle of a war, you could go to a pacifist society and have a speech. There were none of those in Germany. And he was saying eventually the more liberal societies would allow this, and they would pass this, would be wiped out. That voice would be utterly unheard in a fascist society, as it was. He mentioned that Christ did not condemn Roman soldiers for being soldiers, and even praised the centurion for his faith. So he didn't say, well, if you want to become a Christian, you need to resign from the army. He noted that several times the Roman centurions come across much better than the Jews do in terms of their response to Christ. He believed that Christ's admonition to turn the other cheek applied in context to individuals to forbear and forgive, not to nations seeking to check military aggression. And then he said at the end, the weight of Christian and secular authority supports just and useful wars from Augustine and the Anglican 39 Articles from Homer, Plato, and Shakespeare. So it's a fairly traditional justification of a just war. This is in the middle of World War II, which many see as one of the more defensible wars. It is interesting that neither Tolkien nor Lewis came to their war experiences as blank slates. They'd read a lot of war literature. Lewis's first response, he says, in Surprised by Joy, this machine gun bullet went whizzing by his head, and he says, this is what Homer wrote about. This is war. Only C.S. Lewis would immediately think, this is like those classical poems I've been reading. But they did both have a great deal of experience with the rhetoric of war and the idea of noble warfare before they got to the front. I think I might argue that they were so well grounded in that literature, going back to Homer and Virgil, that their own war experiences were somewhat insulated or compartmentalized from the long tradition they had of warfare, noble warfare, in many of the texts they read. But I want to switch to a different concept. Not are we being patriotic, are we being... One of the most fascinating part of Joe's book was all these different countries thinking that we're doing God's work. And that I think very often the patriot says, well, we're God's instrument on earth. So if we don't want to be too patriotic and too presumptuous, the other possibility would be to think that passivism is a direct expression of your Christian faith. And once again, there may be some problems there. So Lewis is actually going to look at a third option, especially comes up in the Screwtape letters. This is Screwtape, and they're working on the patient. I don't know how many of you have read Screwtape letters. He's a senior tempter giving advice to Wormwood, who's an apprentice tempter. And he has one particular subject he keeps calling the patient. This is the person we're going to try to keep from Christian faith or keep from growing in his Christian faith. And when the war starts, Wormwood is delirious. Oh, great, chaos, death, you know, collateral damage. We're really making progress here, the forces of evil. And Screwtape is not as concerned about the war breaking out as he is what's happening in individual souls. He wants to know, how are things going with your patient? You say you're delirious with joy because the European humans have started another of their wars. For the first time in your career, you have tasted the wine, which is the reward of all our labors, the anguish and bewilderment of a human soul. And it has gone to your head. Did the patient respond to some of your terror-filled pictures of the future? Did you work in some self-pitying pictures of a happy past, some fine thrills in the pit of his stomach were there? You played your violin prettily, did you? Well, that's all very well, Wormwood, but remember, duty comes before pleasure. It's fun to think about human suffering and all the anxiety that he's going through, but you've got a job to do. But remember, duty comes before pleasure. Let's think how to use rather than to enjoy this European war. And in Screwtape's mind, this is about spiritual warfare. What are we going to do in the souls of individual human beings through this warfare? And a lot of the best passages of Screwtape letters is, it's easy to hate the Germans. They're over there, they're firing at us, but how about your mother-in-law? Maybe the real issue is getting you to hate your mother-in-law. He has a lot of good advice about how you can actually use a war to cause spiritual decline in individuals rather than spiritual enhancement. Another of Screwtape's quotes: consider whether we should make the patient an extreme patriot or an extreme pacifist. I think Screwtape's ahead of us all here in our discussion that we had the last hour. All extremes are to be encouraged. Not always, of course, but at this period. Some ages are lukewarm and complacent, and then it is our business to soothe them fast asleep. Other ages, such as the present one, are unbalanced and prone to faction, and it is our business to inflame them. So he's immediately thinking, how are we going to use this cultural situation in terms of the spiritual life of individuals? He later on says, whichever side he adopts,
your main task will be the same. Let him begin by treating patriotism or pacifism as part of his religion. Then let him, under the influence of this partisan spirit, come to regard it as the most important part. Then quietly and gradually nurse into them the stage at which religion becomes merely part of the cause, and his faith is valued chiefly for the excellent arguments it can produce in favor of the British war or of pacifism. Provided that meetings, pamphlets, policies, movements, causes, and crusades mean more to him than prayer and the sacraments and charity, he is ours, and the more religious on those terms, securely ours. I could show you a pretty cageful down here. Chris and I have both at our schools in Pennsylvania had people say, I just don't understand how someone could call themselves a Christian and be a Democrat. And someone else will say, I don't know how someone could call themselves a Christian and be a Republican. We've heard that from our students on both sides, and I think that would warm Screwtape's heart to hear those kind of comments. Lewis uses this unusual word patient all the way through Screwtape letters. You're patient, work on this, work on his fears, work on his lust, work on his hatred, his lack of charity. And it's an unusual word until you read other books by Lewis. Owen Barfield said every statement that Lewis made contains every other statement that he made. And so his using of the word patient, when you're reading the discarded image about the medieval worldview, and he brings up this word patient, and you suddenly go, oh, that's why I kept using that word in Screwtape letters. It sounds rather clinical, but he has something more specific in mind. In the discarded image, he talks about the principle of the triad, which was a part of the medieval worldview. There was usually an agent, an intermediary, and a patient, one who's passive, one who's being acted upon, one who acts, one who's being acted upon, and then some intermediary. And he talks about God and then nine ranks of angels and then humans. In the medieval worldview, the three highest ranks didn't interact with humans at all. They merely worshiped God and praised him. And angels and that come to earth, they're rather of the lower ranks. They're out on duty. But between God and humans, there are the nine ranks of angels. Between kings and commoners are the ranks of the nobility. And between reason and the appetites, there's sentiment. It's a very common concept, and this comes up, it's a very important concept in Abolition of Man, in which we have reason, which can give rational arguments for our behavior. We have our appetites, which just give the basic primal needs. But he says we need sentiments, we need moral values, we need aesthetic values. And this is Lewis arguing the need for this intermediary between the agent and the patient. One of his favorite lines from Charles Williams, said in Taliesin through Logris, all lies in a passion of patience, my Lord's rule. And in context, what he meant is, I want to be the actor. I want to be the captain of my soul. But really, ultimately, what you choose is, you are a patient, but who are you going to allow to act upon you? And Lewis picked up this idea in Abolition of Man. This gets quoted in Abolition of Man. So patient in this context has to do not just with being patient with the passage of time, but being patient in the sense of who, what agency you allow to act upon you. And this comes up in a lot of Lewis's different books, the idea that conflict ultimately is spiritual. We've been talking a lot about political solutions and military solutions, but a common outline in Lewis's books is what I call the microcosmic, the macrocosmic, and then the cosmic. So the book will start out with inner struggles of the individual, psychological and moral choices, and then we up the ante to the microcosm, or the macrocosm, external struggles, military struggles, violence, and then ultimately we get to the cosmic. It's interplanetary, it's good versus evil, it's God versus Satan, it's spiritual warfare. And I notice this outline in his fiction especially. In the Screwtape letters, it starts out talking about how to get Wormwood to discourage this one individual who hasn't become a Christian yet, and inflame his lust, make him hate the Germans, make him feel that, oh, there could not be any supernatural, look how normal life is, I've never seen any miracles. So it starts out at the microcosmic level of what's happening within the soul and the mind of the individual person. But then the war breaks out, it becomes macrocosmic, and I read you some quotes where Wormwood is very excited. Now we're really getting somewhere. We're inciting a lot of human violence. And Wormwood, Screwtape still wants him to focus on his individual patient. And at the end of the Screwtape Letters, here's this poor innocent guy. He's just become a Christian. I believe he's engaged. And he's killed in a random bombing, probably in London, part of the Blitz. And for most people, that'd be a very downbeat ending. You go, we've been following this patient in his spiritual growth all the way through the book. And in the last chapter, he's killed by a bomb. What kind of a downbeat ending is that? But actually, in the Screwtape Letters, it's not at all downbeat, because Screwtape says, I was just going to say, darn it. I guess Screwtape can probably say, oh, hell. He says, we lost him. You know, he was just a new Christian. There was still a chance of turning him from aside. And he has this beautiful passage in the very last letter where he says, didn't you see what happened? Just as he was dying, he saw you. He realized that many of his worst thoughts and doubts and fears were being planted in his mind by you. And then he saw angels. He realized how many of his hopes and his charity and his strength to do loving deeds was actually coming from spiritual helpers. And then he saw him with a capital H. And Screwtape is just really discouraged and despairing that he had this epiphany. He had this mystical breakthrough. And he saw that his life was really about spiritual warfare. It was not his own psychology, this and that. Lewis literally believed that both angels and demons could whisper in your ear consciousness. He mentions in Problem of Pain that individuals are subject to just little whispers. It's almost like the idea of the angel on one shoulder and the devil on the other shoulder. He almost literally believed in that image that what's happening in our lives is not always just psychology. Sometimes it could be spiritual warfare. Dostoevsky said, God and the devil are at war, and the battlefield is the human soul. And that very much could be an epigraph from a C.S. Lewis work. Even in Paralandra, we were talking last night, someone asked a very interesting question about how Ransom literally bashes in the head of Weston. And they thought, well, that's not a very satisfying solution. They've been arguing about the problem of evil. I don't know if you know the storyline of Paralandra, but it's an unfallen planet, and the Venus there, the Eve, has not yet made a mistake which would lead to the fall. So Ransom is sent to the planet. He argues with Weston, who's trying to convince Eve that Meleldil actually wants her to disobey him, to assert her free will. And they have lengthy discussions. At the end of the novel, Weston becomes clearly, he talks about the great life force and he calls it within him, and accidentally he basically calls a demon or the devil into himself and becomes possessed. And after that, he's called the Unman. And at one point in the story, after all these arguments about the nature of free will and what God wants for individuals, Ransom realizes this is going to come down to physical battle. And they go way down in a subterranean cavern, and finally Ransom takes a rock and smashes the Unman's head. But then it takes him 3 days to get back out from underneath the mountain. And then he experiences this beatific vision of the great dance, which is straight out of Dante. And I think people were asking, well, wasn't that an unsatisfying ending? Aren't we supposed to refute or convert our enemies? Are we really supposed to pick up a rock and smash their heads? But Lewis, I think, symbolically is saying, we're in the world of mythology. If you go back and look at Paralandra, he goes to Paralandra not in a spaceship, but in a coffin. That could be a clue that Lewis is up to something about spiritual warfare rather than physical space travel. When he gets there on the travels, he was burned on one side of his skin, sunburned, and the other side he wasn't. So the Green Lady calls him piebald because he's got these two different sides. But once again, it's a symbol of inner spiritual warfare. Ransom has been sent on this great mission, but he doesn't feel up to it. Half of him says, well, if this is so important to keep a world from falling like Earth fell, why am such an inadequate person like me sent? So there's a lot of inner doubt and inner questioning, which is represented by his external piebaldness, his dark and light spots. So the novel starts out with his emotional turmoil about whether or not he should even be on this mission. Eventually, the verbal fencing turns into physical combat with the Unman. I take this very symbolically. When he first arrives at Paralandra, he sees a dragon guarding a tree, and this is the Garden of the Hesperides. So he's literally entering into myth. It's almost as if he gets to go be in the Book of Genesis in the world of Paralandra. And so it's a very mythic conflict, and he actually says that in other worlds, the division between history and myth, or between fact and truth, they're erased. They're not separate categories the way we see them here on Earth. And so he combats the unmanned before he smashes his head. He says, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, and then smashes his head, which is an unusual invocation there, which does bother a lot of critics. But I think my theory is that this is still talking about his inner warfare. A lot of things that Weston says about you've got to get on the side of the life force, there is no good and evil, there's only progress, some of the things that Joe was talking about last night. And he's actually destroying a part of himself which is holding him back. I think that Ransom's killing of Weston is taking a part of himself which is going to prevent him from becoming the person that Melendez wants him to become. And I think I can prove that because so many of the things that Weston says are things that Lewis himself wrote in letters before he was a Christian. He's very taken by Henri Bergson. He was taken by Schopenhauer and a lot of these thinkers. And so I think this is Lewis in some ways trying to eradicate a shadow of his former self in this novel. And then obviously at the end, we find out that this whole thing has been cosmic warfare, and he meets the Oyarsa of Paralandra and realizes that, and gets to witness the cosmic dance. And that's one of the most beautiful passages of any of Lewis's literature. And extremely Dantean. He loved Dante, and a lot of those motifs are being incorporated into that final beautiful passage. The Hideous Strength, the same thing. He starts out at the lower end of we're back on Earth, and the National Institute of Coordinated Experiments. When he first meets the lower people in the hierarchy, they think this is just about their careers, and this is the place to be. This is the Silicon Valley of the 1940s. And so they're thinking in terms of individual careerism. As he starts climbing the ladder and meeting new people, he finds out that they have a plot to bring in a neo-fascist state in England. This is written right after the war. And they're going to base it on science. We're going to take all the scientists which have the most prestige, and we're going to inject a totalitarian state here in England. It's interesting, there's a passage, I've been reading about anti-Semitism among British intellectuals, and Lewis has a passage in which these evil people at NICE, N-I-C-E, they want him to write a letter and say there's been a lot of violence in England, which they themselves had incited, but they say, we think it may be the Jews. So it's interesting that Lewis was already satirizing anti-Semitism in That Hideous Strength. Tolkien was the same way. This book on anti-Semitism mentions how many famous intellectuals had what he calls Judenhass, Jew hate. But Tolkien was similar to Lewis. When a German publisher wrote and wanted to publish The Hobbit in German, they had a rule that they would not publish books written by Jews. So he got a letter from a publisher saying, we love The Hobbit, we want to translate it into German. The name Tolkien, we just want to check, that is an Irish name, is it not? They were asking politely whether or not he was Jewish. And he made a joke at first about, no, I'm not Aryan, I've never lived in northern Persia. Linguistically, that's where that comes from. But he says, you seem to be asking whether or not I'm Jewish, and I just want to tell you that I'm of German stock. And he says, I'm sorry that I'm not descended from that admirable race, but if I keep receiving impertinent letters like the one that you sent me, I would start becoming ashamed of my German heritage. So Lewis and Tolkien really stood out in an era of anti-Semitism. But finally, at the end of That Hideous Drink, he discovers it's not just about their personal careers. It's not just about fomenting violence in England and bringing in a new totalitarian state. It's actually spiritual warfare again. They're demonic forces that are keeping the head alive. And they want to, and so the good guys, Ransom now is the head of the forces at St. Anne's, and he needs to have Merlin channel the Oyarsa to Earth to fight these demonic forces. So at the end of the novel, once again, we have this great spiritual battle, rather than, it's not a psychological battle with an individual, it's not a national battle within different political factions, but ultimately it comes back to spiritual warfare. And this often happens in Lewis's books. It starts and ends with spiritual warfare, with spiritual choices at the individual level and ultimately at the cosmic level. Learning in Wartime, I mentioned this essay that he wrote in the autumn after the war began. And he was talking to a bunch of students about why are we studying philosophy and literature and the classics in the middle of a war when they're threatening to wipe out civilization altogether. And he has the very similar tone to that letter he wrote to his father back when he was 15 years old. How can we continue to take an interest in these placid occupations when the lives of our friends and the liberties of Europe are in the balance? Is it not like fiddling while Rome burns? We shouldn't be here in Oxford studying. We should be out on the front line fighting Germans. That's the attitude that he was trying to explain why there was another perspective on that. And later in the essay, he says, I spoke just now of fiddling while Rome burns, but to a Christian, the true tragedy of Nero is not that he fiddled while the city was on fire, but he fiddled on the brink of hell. So once again, he's bringing it back to that individual soul that is at stake rather than the political situation or the military situation. I don't know if I need to read the entire paragraph there, but he also says war creates no absolutely new situation. It simply aggravates the permanent human situation. And he goes on to say, if you look at past periods like the 1850s, when England seemed to be, the empire seemed to be at peace, if you live there or if you look back and study it closely, you'll find alarms and threats of war and rebellions, all sorts of dissent. We tend to be nostalgic about the past, but if you lived in that period, you probably wouldn't think that way. But on the other hand, even in the middle of war, soldiers are still reading novels, they're waiting between battles. He himself, from the trenches of France, wrote back to his father and asked him once for The Mill on the Floss by George Eliot. He's in the middle of bombardment. And then later he asked, even more oddly, he asked to see Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy. I think if you're on the front lines, you've got enough melancholy right in front of you there. You probably don't need to study a book about it. But he's still carrying on his learning even while he was in the trenches. And as you know, Tolkien was beginning to write some of his early myths while he was in the trenches. And he talks about how even condemned men make jokes on scaffolds. Do we know who he's talking about there? He's expecting us all to be so literate. I just did the book that Sarah mentioned, The Pilgrim's Regress. He has French, Latin, Greek, German, some of Dante's medieval Italian, and he's sort of saying, you don't know that? Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe 80 years from now, somebody will come along and put in some annotations so you'll understand that. But he's referring to, I think probably to Thomas More when he was executed. He had a long beard, and he says, well, I hope you're not going to take off the beard. It hasn't done you any harm. He made a number of jokes on the scaffold, classic black humor, discussed poetry while advancing on the walls of Quebec during the War of 1812, the General Montcalm. He got a hold of Thomas Gray's Elegy in a Country Churchyard, and when he read the poem, he said, I would have rather have written this poem than to take Quebec. He was just so astounded by it. And then make jokes on scaffolds, discuss poetry while advancing on the walls of Quebec. I think I left out one about propounding theorems in a besieged city. Archimedes did some of his best work when the city was totally surrounded by their enemies. So he's saying that really it's a continuum between war and peace. It's not one or the other. Peaceful periods have a lot of violence and a lot of agitation, and even in the midst of war. During World War II, there was a young man who'd just been called up from Oxford and was getting ready to go to the front. And he saw him out in the field trying to train a falcon and teach a falcon how to come back on his wrist. And he really admired that he was still trying to revive the art of falconry right in the middle of World War II. He liked people who had that, what we would call that liberal arts spirit of wanting to continue the spark of learning even under the most adverse conditions. This is, once again, going back to the idea that he believed in the cause, but he didn't want people to become overly enthusiastic that this was the ultimate concern. I believe our cause to be, as human causes go, this is World War II, obviously, very righteous, and therefore I believe it to be a duty to participate in this war. Thus, we have a duty to rescue a drowning man, and perhaps if we live on a dangerous coast, to learn life-saving so as to be ready for any drowning man when he turns up. It may be our duty to lose our own lives in saving him. But if anyone devoted himself to life-saving in the sense of giving his total attention so that he thought and spoke of nothing else and demanded the cessation of all other human activities until everyone had learned how to swim, he would be a monomaniac. The rescue of a drowning man is then a duty worth dying for, but not worth living for. A man may have to die for his country, but no man must in any exclusive sense live for his country. He who surrenders himself without reservation to the claims of a nation or a party or a class is rendering to Caesar that which is of all things most emphatically belongs to God himself or herself. So that is my thoughts about Lewis not wanting to take sides on pacifism versus patriotism, but let's all be patient and be open to the agency of God in our lives as opposed to more malign influences. So thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Downing, and thank you for traveling with me on the Lewis Festival Scholar Series today. The third and final talk in this series, Lewis and War, is by Crystal Downing, co-director of the Marion E. Wade Center at Wheaton College, a position she shares with her husband, Dr. David Downing. Crystal's talk is C.S. Lewis and Dorothy L. Sayers at War, a fascinating and enlightening look at this esteemed British author who's had five of her books turned into movies. Her talk will be automatically downloaded to your pod app next week. This entire podcast has been made possible by the C.S. Lewis Festival and its generous sponsors. The 2022 festival takes place the weekend of September 16th with a keynote address by best-selling author Anne Voskamp. To become a part of the Lewis family or to learn more about the festival and this podcast, please go to our website, cslewisfestival.org. Thanks to podcast producer Zach Smith of Hands Media. On behalf of the C.S. Lewis Festival, I'm David Krause.